The views expressed in this program are those of the individual participants and not necessarily those of WVUD or the University of Delaware.
WVUD presents Campus Voices, conversations with University of Delaware faculty, staff, and students about their teaching, research, service projects, and other interests. To introduce today's guest, here's your host, Richard Gordon.
Thank you, Jason. On August 30th, we went up to the Old College Gallery, where we got a preview of First Folio, the book that gave us Shakespeare, and illustrating Shakespeare from Boydell to Baskin. These exhibitions are available in the Old College Gallery through September 25th. For more information, go to www.udel.edu/museums. Here's the conversation we recorded with Emeritus Professor of English, Jay Helio from the University of Delaware, about First Folio, the book that gave us Shakespeare.
You told me something that while we were setting up that I did not realize. What's the first play in the folio?
First play in the folio is The Tempest, which is interesting because it's the last play that Shakespeare wrote on his own. He later collaborated with John Fletcher to write Henry VIII and Two Noble Kinsmen. But this is maybe also a play that we don't have that's not extant called Cardenio, based on one of the novels of the Spanish author
Cervantes,
yes.
The centerpiece here is this one book. Why is this such an important touchstone? Why is this so important to have it at the University of Delaware?
The Folger Library, I think, wanted to celebrate Shakespeare's death, this 400th anniversary of his death. And since they have so many folios, they have over 80 copies of the folio, they decided to send one copy to every state in the Union. Now, the copy that we have is actually looks a little small. I was surprised when I saw it, but then I noticed that the margins had been cropped, had been shortened, which often happens when you're rebinding books. They will crop the edges, which can be somewhat tattered and so on. But it's a very important book, as I mentioned in my talk this morning. More than half of Shakespeare's plays were never published in his lifetime. And we have to depend on the folio for copies of those plays. Plays like As You Like It, Twelfth Night, Coriolanus, Macbeth wasn't even published in his lifetime. Antony and Cleopatra was not published in his lifetime. Winter's Tale wasn't published in his lifetime. 18 plays, only 16 plays of Shakespeare were published in his lifetime. And various kinds of editions, some very good, some not so good.
Put on all these plays, but only 16 of them were published during his time. What was the source material for the folios then? I mean, was it scripts that were kicking around the theater? Or?
Well, we're not sure in every case, but we suspect a lot of them were transcripts of playbooks. Some may actually have been playbooks and or Shakespeare's manuscript that may have been available. But I think many of them were just transcripts or playbooks that the King's men had in their archives and gave to Heming and Condell to use in the collection, which Isaac Jacquard printed.
There's just so much of him that just filters through all of our culture. I mean, I think it's remarkable to have this.
Yes, indeed. In fact, I'm reminded, as you were saying, of the freshman student who read Hamlet for the first time and was surprised it was so full of quotations. But he's had a tremendous influence on us because his plays still speak to us directly. Also, his vocabulary. He introduced scores of words that had never been used before. So his vocabulary is also very fascinating. But most of all, his insight into human nature and his dramatic structure is astounding. He's probably, in my view, the best playwright that ever lived.
Anyone who's been raised in a family with siblings can relate to some part of the tragedy of King Lear.
Yes, that's my favorite play and probably Shakespeare's greatest tragedy. It's the most complete tragedy. Hamlet, which is the most fascinating tragedy, and used to be the one most often produced on the stage, has been superseded lately by King Lear. Hamlet goes off in a number of different directions, but if you try to follow any one of them to its end, you wind up with a stone wall. As I've tried to do, I've tried to analyze the play in terms of Christian theology or revenge tragedy and so on. And what Shakespeare did in Hamlet was to bring into question the whole idea of personal vengeance, which, of course, both the state and the church oppose very vigorously. In King Lear, he didn't have that problem. He had a different problem, which he mastered beautifully. He wove together two plots, the Lear plot and the Gloucester plot, which complement each other. King Lear, whose older children treated him so shabbily, his reaction was defiance. In the storm scene, he says, "Do your utmost, I will endure." Gloucester, on the other hand, the Earl of Gloucester, whose younger son deceived him to the point where Gloucester was blinded by Regan and Cornwall in that play, has the opposite reaction. He wants to commit suicide, and it remains for Edgar to try to cure him of that affliction, and he ultimately succeeds, fortunately.
I've often thought that the first Shakespeare play that should be taught to high school kids isn't Twelfth Night, which is the first one I was taught. The one that still speaks to everybody is Macbeth.
Yes, Macbeth is very popular in the schools. It's one of Shakespeare's shortest plays, and students tend to like that aspect of it. But the play that I think is an excellent introduction to Shakespeare is Midsummer Night's Dream, his most delightful comedy, which is a very complex comedy, but you don't get lost in it. It's very clearly presented. And I love to teach it because it's so much fun. And have students act it. They enjoy it very much also.
Oh, I mean, just the wall and all these things that the students can do and the acting.
Yes, I gave up the term paper years ago when I was teaching Shakespeare. And the term project was for students to act out scenes from Shakespeare. They could choose the scenes, but many of them selected the last scene of Midsummer Night's Dream, the Pyramus and Thisbe scene. And did a marvelous job of it.
One of the things that is really important about a work like the First Folio circulating around the country is it's important for students to remember that there are primary works. It's not just looking at editions with footnotes and everything. I mean,
yes, I discovered not long ago that when I talked about the publication of Shakespeare's plays and the difficulties of establishing which was the authentic version of the play, students became fascinated. They wanted to know more about that. And so that's a little diversion from analyzing the tragedies as tragedies or comedies as comedies, but to get into the way in which the play actually came into print, how we got to know it. They were amazed to find out the various complexities involved in bringing the play into print. And so I began to talk a little bit more about that in my classes.
How do we know which of these three playbook versions is the one to choose as the authentic one?
Well, as a matter of fact, what a modern director does is to take one of the modern editions of the play and then chop it up the way he wants to or she wants to, because Shakespeare's Hamlet, for example, is much too long. In modern editions, it's a conflation of the second quarto and the folio. So it's much longer than any play Shakespeare expected to see performed. So many, and directors also have a point that they want to make, a point of view they want to present. So they will fashion the play, cut it, and direct it in such a way to bring out their point of view, their concept for the play.
A lot of students will think of Shakespeare, he wrote it this way, this is the way it always is, but it's drama. It's open for interpretation by whoever is acting it and whoever's presenting it.
Yes, that's right, and that's why he continues to hold the boards, because there's so many different ways of presenting it. Some are cockeyed, I admit, but many of them give us new insights into the play. For example, I saw a production of Richard II where Richard was made to look like the Tsar of Russia and Bolingbroke, the usurper, was made to look like Lenin. It was a 19th century dress costume, and it made a certain point. It wasn't the best production of the play I've ever seen, but it made a certain point, and it was a director's way of sort of updating the play.
Now, when people come up to the Old College Gallery here through September 25th to view the folio, what is it that they actually are going to see?
Well, they're going to see two pages from the play of Hamlet, including the most famous line in Shakespeare, to be or not to be. That is the question. That's where it's open to. And there also is a facsimile, which they can actually touch and browse through. They can't touch the actual folio that we have under glass, but fortunately the museum has put a facsimile, the Hinman facsimile, which they can browse through if they want to.
How many works are in the folio?
Well, the catalog published at the beginning of the folio lists 35 plays, but actually there are 36. Troilus and Cressida, which was supposed to follow Romeo and Juliet among the tragedies, they had to stop printing after they printed about three or four pages because they didn't have the rights, apparently. After the folio was almost complete, they got the rights. So they continued printing it, but they had to put it by itself between the histories and the tragedies and didn't number the pages.
You've taught Shakespeare to students and graduate students for a long time. What's been a memory that stands out for you as something that is just an aha moment for a student when he or she first encountered something in Shakespeare?
Well, as I said before, I had students perform scenes from Shakespeare, and one group of students decided to do scenes from As You Like It, and the student who played Touchstone decided to play Touchstone as if he were W.C. Fields. Now Touchstone. Now, Audrey, it worked so amazingly. I've never forgotten it. And I asked him to do something he hadn't prepared in the same fashion, and it continued to blow me away. So there, you give students the opportunity to be creative, and 9 times out of 10, they won't disappoint you.
In addition to the first folio in the Old College Gallery, there is an exhibition around the outside of the hall illustrating Shakespeare from Boydell to Baskin. And University of Delaware Director of Museums Janice Tomlinson took us on a tour.
Yeah, the reason I put this exhibition together is, you know, the 400 years, it's 400 years since Shakespeare died, but it's also 400 years of Shakespeare's afterlife. And if you think the first folio is one step in his afterlife, as his plays go from memories, from things performed on stage, from passing in time, to something that is recorded and collected in the volume that is the first folio. And another way, of course, that we remember his plays is through images. If you think of Shakespeare, does an image come to mind? I think for me it does. From the first time I was in junior high and brought into Boston to see a production of Romeo and Juliet, I started thinking about images and what they do. I started thinking, and also how images really are very selective. You know, there are a lot of scenes in Shakespeare that don't lend themselves very well to illustrations and things that are dropped out, but we have never this tradition of images. The first folio was published in 1623, and really almost a century would pass before there was any illustrated version of Shakespeare, the beginning of the 18th century. Then things started picking up. You know, there were some very curious engravings by a French artist named Gravelot that have his characters cast in Rococo costumes. Other things, prints by Hogarth, or scenes actually done by English artists after performances of Shakespeare's plays. But I think one of the turning points in the illustration of Shakespeare, and that's where our exhibition begins, is with a project by a very well-known publisher in London, John Boydell, and it is the Boydell Shakespeare Gallery and the prints made after that. Apparently in about 1785, Boydell was having supper with a bunch of worthies, including artists such as Joshua Reynolds, who was president of the Royal Academy. And they were talking about the status of art, and they were talking about particularly the status of history painting in England. Because at that point, history painting was a big thing. The French Academy was sort of taking, you know, had established its reputation along the paintings of historical narrative. And they conceived of a project to commission English artists of standing to paint scenes of drawn from Shakespeare. So anyway, they commissioned the paintings. You can actually go online, do a search of the Boydell Gallery, and they've recreated the gallery as it was on Pall Mall, installed the paintings. But then to make money, they did prints after the paintings. Now, we have two prints I'd like to call your attention to. One is this thing that is a satire of Boydell's project, and it's by a very well-known artist named James Gilray, a very great, great satiric caricaturist. And he apparently lost his bid to become the printmaker for Boydell, and he was apparently not very happy about this. So he shows John Boydell in his robes. Boydell was also an alderman, and these are the robes of him as alderman, who is sacrificing Shakespeare. The title is Shakespeare Sacrificed, or The Offering to Avarice, to Greed. So here we have him sort of throwing the works of Shakespeare into the flames. The flames rise. On this stone behind, that's standing on the book, which is a tome which has the names of the subscribers, the people who were subscribing to the series of Boydell prints, sits this little gnome-like avarice with bags of money under each of his scrawny arms. And then floating adrift in the crowds, you have all these figures from Midsummer Night's Dream, from other plays, that are drawn from the paintings in the Shakespeare Gallery. And, you know, this was one by Fuseli Buck. There you have King Lear, The Madness of King Lear. There you have here a figure that we'll see two engravings down. That is the ghost of Hamlet's father. So he's really satirizing the endeavor, saying, you know, it's sacrificing the great works of Shakespeare just to make a profit. They circulated widely. The Boydell prints were actually reprinted in mid-19th century America. In 1852, there was a set of them. And one of the works that we acquired for the show was this wonderful print of Hamlet, who sees the ghost of his father, and he is being drawn back. The ghost beckons him to follow, and his friends are trying to keep him from doing that. And it is after a painting that was probably the star of the show by a Swiss artist who worked in London, Heinrich Fuseli, who was known for his spooky, eerie things. He's very well known for a painting of a woman having a nightmare. And here, too, you can see this ghost sort of appears in an engraving with light glowing out of it, with sort of glowing eyes, kind of the supernatural creature of that late 18th century England, which is the era of the Gothic. And it's interesting how, you know, we have, I mean, Hamlet was a favorite play. A lot of people like to illustrate it. And we have next to it, just for sort of a change of pace, is there are two watercolors here that I found in the Winterthur, the collection of the Winterthur Library and Gardens. And they are signed and dated by a certain Everetta Clinch, and they are dated 1796. One of them is New York, 1796. So this was apparently an amateur watercolorist. They are watercolors. And here she shows Ophelia from Hamlet gone mad. Now, she improvises. She adds characters to the scene, which when Ophelia is singing is between Ophelia and the mother of Hamlet. Here she stages, adds characters. We really don't know where she got her idea. But here is a woman, amateur watercolorist, working in New York in 1790s, creating these scenes, creating these watercolors. What inspired her? Thanks to the wonderful databases of American newspapers, one finds that Shakespeare plays were produced. The Boydell prints were offered for sale in New York, some of them saying, you know, in framed and suitable for your mantelpiece.
Wow.
And, of course, there was an edition of Shakespeare's tales that was also advertised in the papers in the 1790s, just to show how Shakespeare was, you know, spread beyond England, as did the Boydell prints.
There are all sorts of different styles.
That's the other thing that I really wanted to show, is just the vast variety. I mean, one could do a history of book illustration, the techniques of book illustration, such as
there's
this
a woodcut.
One. A woodcut, and this is from a little-known artist around 1940. It's kind of got an Art Deco sense about it now. It's interesting how, you know, the little thin-waisted, the figure of Hamlet is very close to how Fuseli showed him, sort of almost a Nureyev dancer kind of figure here confronting his mother. And this is an isolated piece that I found at the Delaware Art Museum The artist did murals in California, but honestly, I haven't been able to find that much more about the artist. But he is working in woodcut rather than engraving. We have it. And then the other thing was, well, do I just do a straight chronological survey, or do I do something different? And I thought, well, maybe I'll arrange when we have groupings of plays. So the groupings of Hamlet, three of Hamlet, late 19th century to mid 20th century. And then I turned to The Tempest, where we have open with another watercolor by Everetta Clinch, showing, you know, Miranda, the first time she sees, you know, the man who would become her beloved, Ferdinand. And jumping from that sort of romantic vision of the this far-off island with its cypress trees and Prospero and Caliban in the back.
And I love, instead of the sun or the moon, there's
Ariel.
A harpist, Ariel, up in the clouds.
Yeah, exactly. It's lovely. It's just, you know, an imagination. And it doesn't... The first thing I did when I looked at these was I looked up the Boydell prints and said, well, was she drawing her inspiration from them? No. I mean, she apparently read the play and imagined these things.
Over here on the far wall, there's one that looks downright humorous.
It's supposed to be. Again, this is a loan from the Delaware Art Museum, where, you know, they have a wonderful collection of American illustration, 20th century illustration in particular. And Leslie Thrasher, the artist who did this, was a student of Howard Pyle. And from 1926 to 32, he created a series for the cover of the magazine Liberty. It was a weekly magazine. And it featured the courtship of this couple. It was almost, well, it wasn't quite the honeymooners for the 1920s, but not too different. Because here we see them dressed, okay, we're looking at Lil Morse and Sandy Jenkins. Sandy Jenkins dressed in the outfit of Julius Caesar, and Lil admiring herself in her compact mirror, dressed as one would assume Cleopatra. And he is, you know, sort of clearly uncomfortable. And the line, this would be the cover of the magazine, and then they would open up, and his line, is just the title of the caption, is, "I'm dying, Egypt, dying." This was a magazine cover.
Yeah.
It shows that people got the joke. And it attests to sort of the widespread knowledge and popularity as part of the English-speaking culture, you know? Our 20th century is mainly represented through artists working as illustrators for luxury editions of Shakespeare. Mm. And usually everything on this wall, as well as the illustrations of King Lear by Oscar Karkoschka, are meant to be seen within a folio and against the printed page. These are unbound folios, so, you know, we can extract them and frame them for this exhibition. Leonard Baskin is a very well-known printmaker. He also had a press called the Gehenna Press, and he undertook a mission that he was going to do the complete plays of Shakespeare in luxury editions, all illustrated. He then realized that was sheer hubris to try to undertake that, and he only produced two illustrated plays. I'll show them both here. The first one was Titus Andronicus. Have you read it?
No.
Not many people have. I read it, and I couldn't I was just amazed at the nature of this play. And it's summarized in a quote from the Paris Review. In its five grisly acts, 14 people die, at least one is raped, throats are cut, hands, tongues, and heads are cut off, blood spurts. It's just a bloodbath. It's almost so gruesome as to be funny. Why he chose this play as his first... We don't know. I was interested in it because it is Baskin, because also he's working here in etching to... Usually these illustrations show individual characters who appear in the play. Versus at the end of the wall, we have Leonard Baskin's Othello illustrations that are woodcut illustrations. And just sort of, I wanted to represent his undertaking in that. The other illustration I wanted to... again, this is another book done by the great Austrian artist Oskar Karkoschka, who is usually identified, as he was early in his career, with the movement of German Expressionism. He was mad with World War II. He was declared a degenerate artist. He had to leave. And he then moved to London, which became his home, and he became a citizen. And he was chosen to illustrate King Lear. I've read about these, and people don't particularly like them. Well, first of all, I tell Kokoschko's story because of the suffering he had gone as an emigre, as a refugee. Would it make him sort more sympathetic to the plight of Lear, cast out, wandering, possibly? And he uses he is working in a lithographic crayon. Critics don't like these. I like them because Kokoschko, we know, looked at Goya's drawings, and his use, his very energetic, almost raw use of the lithographic crayon really suggests to me that he was looking at the late lithographic drawings of Goya, the late lithographs of Goya. Also, I think there's kind of a raw, crude expressionism in these. For example, this of Lear mourning the dead Cordelia, which is just kind of this nervous, raw line that just is, to me, so terribly expressive. I think this is a lovely, again, three illustrations drawn from maybe a dozen illustrations in the book. I can't remember. Actually, I have a friend at the Prado who tells a story of an older man sketching after Goya's black paintings who identified himself as Kokoschka. So, and the friend is a curator of Goya, so I think she gets her flex right.
Down this wall here, we've got these splashes of color.
I am looking forward to having people interpret these for me. These are fascinating, I find. These are by Ron King, who started a press in England, the Circle Press. And he does beautiful illustrated books. And again, his images are meant to be set against his written page, which is in beautiful, beautiful type press.
These are expressionistic interpretations of specific lines, if you will, to put up next to them.
Lines, but also characters. He inscribes them, Macbeth. And he was working earlier on a series of masks. But this appears to me that he took a photograph and screen printed a photo. So this has a mask-like quality about it with the jaw, and there's almost looking kind of like a skull and kind of like a dagger. It's very suggestive. And also those colors of black and red are his masculine colors, and they'll appear at the end of the series with Macduff. But how he made that, I mean, look at the base of that and this, and it looks like a kind of 60s mod furniture or mod something that he's screen printed on and turned over.
Those plastic chairs, yeah,
exactly.
I remember those.
Exactly. How he got this, and this is the witches, okay, and so you have these swirling lines and sort of this mystic swirling quality. I love the next one, Lady Macbeth, okay. But screw your courage to the sticking place, and we will not fail. And here he shows a very sexual thing of, you know, light bulbs and a sort of a fluorescent light sort of being stuck, and this idea of screwing things in with these images that are from pop art of the 1960s. How, I mean, that struck me with his clear sort of play on that the word of, you know, screwing up your courage. And it's also interesting to see Lady Macbeth against Lady Macduff. Because here you have an abstraction. You have sort of what looks like a stick, maybe a plain sort of rectangle. Let's think of a popsicle stick for those people who can't see it. And on top of it is a square, but it's skewed, so it's kind of diamond-shaped sitting on it. And then there are two sort of tear-like shapes.
I thought of them as petals. Petal shape, flower petal
shapes. Petal shapes. It's far more feminine, certainly, than the electric analogies that are used for the cruel Lady Macbeth. Lady Macduff is, of course, the woman who loves her children, who stays with her children, who is murdered with her children after her husband has left. And so here you have, you know, those round things. Well, are they tears? Are they breasts suggesting motherhood? What is it? I think it's just a very evocative image. But I'm interested to see, you know, as we talk about these with other people, what they see.
And the Shakespeare Folio is here
through Sunday, September 25th.
And the images?
They will also come down after September 25th. Because after that, we're going to install a wonderful faculty exhibition of our great practicing artists at UD. And that'll open on October 5th.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Richard. It's always a pleasure.
Thanks for listening to Campus Voices. The views expressed on this program are those of the individual guests and do not necessarily reflect the official views or policies of WVUD or the University of Delaware. For more information about Campus Voices and to find archive copies of this and other episodes, visit our website. Using all lowercase letters, go to www.udel.edu/campusvoices. We invite you to tune in every Thursday morning at 8:30 for Campus Voices on 91.3 FM, WVUD, and WVUD HD1, Newark, or online at wvud.org.